Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well, Tim. How are you doing?
Doing great. It's Friday. It's August. Kids are going back to school. I couldn't be happier.
Happy August.
Happy August. And you know the other thing that's made me happy? After months and months and months, the executive order on outbound investment that the Biden administration has been promising has finally arrived. It was issued on August 9th. There was an executive order and an accompanying notice of proposed rulemaking by the Treasury Department. And with us to discuss this momentous occasion are our first two repeat guests on the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, Ann Saladin and Brian Curran, who are partners in our trade group, who've been following this issue since the beginning.
Hey, Tim and Mike, great to be back.
Brian, good to talk to you. Ann, how are you?
I'm doing well, and what an honor to be your first repeat guest. There's a lot that has happened since we spoke, I think, last in March, so really glad to be here.
Well, thank you both for being on here, and as Ann said, we kind of previewed this outbound investment screening regime back in March, but we finally have the executive order, and we also have the Treasury Department issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which I think, from my understanding, gets into actually a little more detailed in the executive order. So we kind of want to ask you about both of these. So, you know, what happened? What's in the EO? What's in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking? And also why have these come out now?
Yeah, maybe I'll start, Mike. So the sort of stepping back in terms of just the background, we touched on this a bit on the previous episode that we were on, but the background here is that both the administration and Congress has thought for a couple of years now that there was this particular concern, national security concern, about U.S. investors potentially funding the Chinese military. And so the administration looked at this and said, well, we've got export controls to capture the issue of tech transfer to places like China in particular. We've got sanctions to capture transactions with particular Chinese entities. And we've got CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, to capture Chinese investments, restrictions on Chinese investments into U.S. tech companies. But we have this gap that we don't have a way to monitor and potentially prohibit investments by U.S. investors into Chinese technology companies, particularly ones that might be aiding, supporting the Chinese military. And so the administration is looking at this, and Congress, as we need this comprehensive strategy, so we need to fill this gap. So as you mentioned, the executive order was issued on August 9th, and what this executive order does is it finally establishes a framework for this outbound investment regime. And it in some cases prohibits transactions, and in other cases it just requires that you notify the Treasury Department. And essentially the way it works is U.S. persons will be either required to notify Treasury, or they'll be prohibited from engaging in transactions with what the executive order is calling persons of a country of concern, which for now is just China, when those persons are engaged in activities in three sectors in particular. So it's the chip sector, chips and microelectronics, quantum, and AI. So your prototypical investment that they're looking at is a U.S. investor investing in a Chinese company that's engaged in one of these sectors. So that's the executive order that lays this out at a high level. And then, as you mentioned, there's then the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, AMPRAM, that the Treasury Department put out, and that does put a little bit more meat on the bone. It floats certain defined terms, gives you a sense of the kinds of transactions in certain sectors that they are considering prohibiting, the kinds of transactions they're considering for just notification, and various exceptions that they're considering. So there's a lot more to chew on, but it is still just an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. It's not a rule, and it's not even a proposed rule at this stage. The key thing to point out about the advance notice of proposed rulemaking is it's got more than 80 questions in there. And some of those 80 questions are multi-part questions. So they are seeking the public's input in this regime to try to flesh things out and to try to avoid pitfalls that they've been, you know, talking to industry about for the last couple of years.
Great. And quickly, before we pivot to sort of what the next steps are, and I'll ask Anne, I think, to probably walk us through that. I did want to note that the country of concern not only is mainland China, but also includes Hong Kong and Macau. That's correct, right, Brian?
That's right. That's exactly right.
I thought that that was interesting. The advance notice of proposed rulemaking was quite lengthy, and we'll put that and the executive order and Anne and Brian's bios all in the show notes. But Anne, so what's happening now? Brian identified that there's 80 questions, some of them multi-part, and that they're seeking comments. So what's happening now in that comment process?
You know, Tim, just before we get there, can I ask a question of Brian? I heard the description, but here's a key question. The administration's approach has sometimes been referred to as a small yard, big fence approach. Looking at the EO and the ANPRAM, it seems like this is the case with respect to technologies, but maybe not to the overall effort. Do you have a view about that? That's my view. Do you have a view about it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think to an extent, with when you look at the sectors, it is fairly narrow. But as I think we'll get into later in the episode, I think there are some broader ranging implications of what kinds of companies might be implicated. And I think we're going to see that you can have investors implicated, as you know, Anne, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Great. So Tim, with respect to your question there, I think that what's going to happen now, the clock is ticking. And by that, I mean, we are in the comment period. And there are 45 days from the publication of the ANPRAM for the public to comment. And that's really quite a short period. And I believe that that date is by September 28th. It will be super important for the public to comment on these because, as Brian mentioned, we've got over 80 questions posed in the ANPRAM. And that means that Treasury is wrestling with all of these questions. And so in order to make our views known, or for companies to make their views known to shape the process, it's really important to do that. So it's really quite an urgent request that companies ought to think about doing that now. In particular, I would just mention that in the private equity space, to me, when I read through these questions, there are a number of questions in particular in that area that I think private equity might want to focus in on and might want to make their views known.
Any other sectors in particular or issues in the set of 80 questions that jumped out at either of you?
Where to start?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think what sort of jumped out at me is really that the administration really is kind of bending over backwards to try to get this right and to try to address the various concerns that we've heard outlined by the tech sector, by the financial sector over the last few years, right? Because the administration, as you know, Tim, has done a significant outreach to those sectors in particular. And I think you see that they are responding in many ways to the criticisms about, you know, breadth, not just in sectors, but breadth across the whole regime in terms of what persons it would cover, et cetera. And I think you see not only that, but unfortunately, what you also see is how tricky it is, because despite some of these issues having been out there for a while, they don't yet have solutions. And so they are still seeking input because some of these issues are quite tricky, and they have not really reached a conclusion on in many areas quite yet.
Yeah, I would say that to me, Treasury's message to the public is make your case or forever hold your peace. So it's super important to get out there and comment.
So what's going to be expected at the end of this process? The comments, close September 28th, and then there'll still need to actually be regulations issued. What do you kind of, when do you kind of expect maybe that'll come out, and maybe even time period here?
So I think what we know now is that the comments are due September 28th, unless they're extended. And then next up will be a proposed rule. And I think the timing is really uncertain because I would expect it would take Treasury some lengthy time to work through all of these comments and maybe to be talking with various stakeholders about their comments. So I think there will be, after the comment period, there'll be probably a lengthy period of time, then a proposed rule. And I think that it's likely that public will have the ability to comment at that point. But it seems to me at that point, it's going to be a more limited ability to comment. So again, back to the point that now is really the time to comment. But I think after that, I don't see any world in which we have final regulations before 2024, quite frankly. There are a lot of technical definitions, and how these technical definitions are defined, but also how they work together with one another to make an effective framework is complicated and will really take time. I think it's important to realize it's not like CFIUS, where FIRMA, it went through an overhaul some years back. The government is creating a regime from scratch here. And so that makes it infinitely more complicated. I think the ultimately, if there isn't clarity about these terms and how they work together, that the ultimate risk is that those deals just won't happen. And I think that, you know, people want to think very carefully about that.
I agree with Anne in terms of the timing issue, that if this is a regime that potentially impacts your investment, your business, this is the time to get engaged, because you can already see based on the AMPRM that the administration has thought quite a bit about this. They've got a whole series of defined terms. So it's not as though there's nothing that they, you know, they're going to be building off a little bit of something they've already developed. So if you're engaging only at the point at which they have issued a proposed rule, let's say, you know, it's not that it's set in stone at that point, but it's going to be more challenging at that point because the regime will be sort of largely formed at that point in time. And it's going to be more difficult to get fundamental changes to the regime, I think, at the proposed rule stage.
Perhaps taking just sort of a step back, you know, you've both been watching this process unfold for months and sort of actually probably over a period of a couple of years. And, you know, overall, kind of what were your first impressions? You know, were there areas that surprised you either in terms of the mix between notification and prohibition, sectors that you may have expected, you know, would have been included that weren't? Just sort of some, you know, thoughts and also in sort of on the craftsmanship, if you will, so far of what the administration's done.
Yeah, I would say, Tim, from my perspective, it was a mix of largely a mix of sort of things that were totally expected and then some other elements that were, I don't know if I would say they were surprises necessarily, but that do present a few issues for investors around the world that they might not have been thinking about originally because it wasn't sort of a headline issue when this has been discussed in the news in the last, you know, 18 months or so. I feel like, you know, when you look at sectors, right, the fact that it covers, you know, chips and quantum and AI is not a surprise to anyone who's been watching this space. I think the question was more about on sectors, would it include a couple of others? So like proposed legislation in Congress now hits on hypersonics. So that's not here. There had been talk here and there of biotech, although that had begun to fade over the last few months, and whether that would be captured, that's not captured. And then there was also, you know, the legislation, for example, has a broader list of countries, and this was focused for now just on China. And then I think on the notification and prohibition element, I think that obviously we were aware that they were considering both. And in a way, it's not really a surprise that they sort of took a tweener approach. Some of the transactions are going to be outright prohibited, and then others will be notifications. And I think we shouldn't be surprised to see that some that are notifications now might turn out to be prohibitions later, once the administration gets more data. I also think that ultimately, the administration was consistent with their message for the last year or more about it being narrowly tailored when we think about the sectors, right? Because ultimately, it's just three sectors, and it's not, candidly, it's not every activity in those sectors. It is a discrete, in some cases, a number of activities. Now, there's some tricky issues about how they define those subsectors in some cases, but it is narrow in that sense. I think, though, that the one way in which it is a bit broader than the public might have originally recognized that it would be is in the way it could impact non-US investors. And so, for example, you have instances where you could have a US investment, say, in a German company that derives, you know, the majority of its revenue from Chinese subsidiaries in the chip sector, for example. Investments in that German company by an American investor could be caught by these rules. And then similarly, you could have a scenario where you're investing in a UK company that's developing a quantum computer, but that UK company is majority owned by a Chinese citizen. That sort of investment could ultimately be caught by the regime. So I think it's those aspects of the regime that are not as obvious to investors and that really need to be focused on, because I think it has broader application in the sense of the number of investors it could hit than many investors, much of the public, was originally thinking.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it was largely as expected, but in terms of the definition of technological sectors, but the scope of application is broader than expected. And I think, you know, that may just be a function of, it may take more thinking to get through that. Brian mentioned a couple of the points that go to that point. I would also mention a situation in which you have a U.S. investor who controls a foreign subsidiary. And there's language in it as it currently stands that there would be some form of obligation on the part of the U.S. investor to understand and to take all reasonable efforts to prevent that foreign subsidiary from making some investment that would otherwise be prohibited by the U.S. person. There are many other sort of similar kinds of things that are described. And then, Tim, you asked about craftsmanship. It's not surprising, but what I found super interesting about this is that, in fact, a lot of these definitions and rules derive from a whole host of other regimes within the government. So, for example, a large portion of it, for example, the covered transaction definition, come from the CFIUS regime. There are other pieces of it that come from the OFAC regime. There are yet other pieces that come from other areas, the October 7th rule, et cetera. So how those all work together will be really interesting, because they don't normally work together. And so that's a real challenge.
Yeah. Another aspect that I think is going to be challenging is that in a couple of the activities in these sectors that are restricted, some of them are restricted based on technologies that are exclusively designed for a particular end use, or for example, exclusively designed for an AI system, exclusively designed for a military end use. And I think in many cases, that's going to be a tricky issue to analyze, given the way technology is and given the dual use nature of so many technologies. So, you know, some of these technologies, I think, could very easily, even though the original intent might have been for military, it could be pretty quickly shown to have some other non-military end use. And in that way, makes it difficult for the investor to assess, am I investing in a company that is designing something exclusively for the military? Or is it more of a dual use item that could be used for either a commercial end use or a military defense end use?
And obviously there, the Chinese military civil fusion doctrine blurs everything,
right,
probably to the detriment of an American investor.
Yeah, that's exactly
and,
right.
And the other point about that, Tim, to your point, is really a fundamental due diligence point. How does one find out about these companies and what they're doing? I mean, there's sort of a level of lack of transparency that may well be difficult in terms of finding out whether or not such a company is engaged in the activities that would be prohibited.
And sort of the transparency or lack thereof regarding events in China is a, you know, topic we can and probably should devote another episode to at another time, because, you know, that is a complicating factor, not only here, but, you know, in a whole range of endeavors.
So another point on China, you mentioned, like, I think, Anne, you mentioned it, the October 7th export control rules on semiconductor chips of a certain size. We saw China retaliate, I think, in a way that was specifically tied to that when they issued their own export controls on, I think it's gallium and germanium. And that just happened this summer, I believe. So that was kind of a tit-for-tat move with China responding on their own export control restrictions. So we can't help but wonder, they're going to read all this news as well. Does anyone here, you know, expect, will China retaliate in some way about the outbound investment regime here that's coming into play?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. I don't think we've seen anything yet, to my knowledge, but I think that China probably will retaliate in some form, but likely in a manner that would not cause a huge escalation of tensions between the two countries. And I think in part that's because the China's economy is not in the best place, but also it seems to me that both countries have an interest in stabilizing the relationship at this point. And also the program in some respects has been narrowly tailored. I do think it was helpful that Secretary Yellen was there in advance to talk about the forthcoming EO and AMPRAM. I think that was a smart move personally on the part of the administration. I'm sure others have different views.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I think the other thing is that even if the Chinese were to retaliate, it's probably going to be some sort of retaliation that would not be exactly parallel, right? In other words, Chinese restrictions in the sense that right now, you know, Chinese restrictions, let's say in our sectors, in the same sectors, because the amount of Chinese investment in those sectors in the U.S. has shrunk significantly based on CFIUS concerns, essentially our U.S. national security concerns, and then the Chinese own restrictions on outbound investment, in some cases currency controls. So anything they would do would be exactly parallel, and they might choose something else, you know, for example, making it even more difficult for U.S. companies to operate in China. But you know, Tim, welcome your thoughts on that too as a close China watcher.
Yeah, and also I was just going to say, Tim, any indication as to whether Secretary Raimondo's trip is still on target?
So actually yesterday, I believe the Chinese commerce, you know, MOFCOM or whatever, they had their weekly press availability, and the spokesperson was asked about that and said that the visit was still, they looked forward to welcoming Secretary Raimondo. No date was given, so they're working on a date still. So they may be dragging their feet a little bit on that. But I tend to agree with, you know, what everyone has said here, that, you know, there will be some kind of response. The response will sort of be in a time, place, and manner of Beijing's choosing. That to some extent, they're a little bit constrained right now. You know, Mike mentioned the germanium and gallium, not so much restrictions, but sort of regime that they put in place a few weeks ago. And the only thing that's really done is to sort of reinforce to the rest of the world the reasons why we were engaged in this sort of de-risking process to begin with. And so I think that, you know, it is going to cause Xi Jinping and his team to sort of think long and hard about how and when they roll this out. And I do also think that both Biden and Xi are invested in seeing that some kind of a meeting takes place on the margins of the APEC summit in November. And so I think that is causing some degree of good behavior on both sides. We'll see whether that holds for the next 3 months. But obviously, it's not only sort of the Chinese reaction that we need to sort of consider here, but also, you know, the sort of the rest of the world, and most importantly, sort of our allies, particularly the Europeans, and then also our East Asian allies, and whether, you know, they are going to see fit to sort of join in as well. And I'd welcome any thoughts that Anne and Brian have on that topic.
Sure. You know, I think ultimately there will be some partners and allies that will join in, but really not anytime soon. But I think this is a really critical point you raised, Tim, because it's going to be critical for allies and partners to put in place their own regimes if the U.S. is going to put in place this regime, because basically if the U.S. stops funding in areas, certain technological areas, and the void is just picked up by our allies and partners, it will have an effect on the overall program. I do know that there have been a lot of discussions between the U.S. and its allies and partners. In fact, I think that has been somewhat responsible for the length of time that it has taken for the EO to be issued. Here's what I understand. I understand that the European Commission is considering a targeted investment instrument on outbound screening and is going to present some initial ideas by the end of the year. I also understand that the EU-US Trade Council has committed to meet regularly to exchange information. Germany's Deputy Chancellor has voiced support for a mechanism. And UK, I think, recently also said that it will consider a similar mechanism. So there's a lot of dialogue, no commitments. And I think it's the case that not all states have the same view here. And remember that this is all occurring at the time that in fact, all of these allies and partners are beefing up their own inbound regimes, really at the behest of the United States. So there's a lot going on. I do think one interesting question to keep a watch out for is what happens out of the Camp David discussions. Curious to what you think, Tim and Brian. Will there be any statement by South Korea and Japan with respect to their interest in putting place a similar mechanism?
And for our listeners, we're recording this on August 18th, Friday. And as we're recording this, President Biden is hosting the Japanese Prime Minister and the Korean President at Camp David.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot imagine it would not be a topic of conversation with the Japanese or the South Koreans. And, you know, the administration, as you said, Anne, has been working on this for quite some time, pushing allies to put out their own regime. And it's clear their strong preference, right? I mean, if you look at, you know, something like the Russian sanctions program, we've seen in particular how much more effective that ultimately was when joined by our allies. The administration has pointed out that when they expanded the jurisdiction of CFIUS and introduced mandatory filings and got, you know, a little bit more robust in terms of the way that the U.S. reviewed in particular Chinese investments into U.S. tech companies, that they saw that was at least a factor in other allies either expanding existing regimes or developing regimes to do the same thing. So there's no question that continues to be a big effort of theirs. And as you say, and ultimately, if the U.S. is standing alone, if the U.S. is the only game in town on this outbound restrictions, you know, at least among the major economies, it's not going to be nearly as effective. So I think they're going to continue to push this, you know, while they're still developing their own regime, meaning now, and even after the regime is established.
And just from my perspective, my sense is that, you know, the Europeans, you know, they will produce something at the end of the year and that we will get action out of Tokyo and Seoul. I think that there's too much alignment on too many other issues with respect to China to allow this to kind of sort of sit out, you know, as an outlier, especially when in many ways it's really sort of central to the sort of to the dilemma that the West faces with China.
So what else do we think might happen in this space? I know, Anne, you used the phrase you've heard in this context, you know, small yard and high fence is sort of the goal here. But do we think this is going to be expanded? By that, I mean the regime in general. And then this is also a question I think for Tim as well is, you know, what actions do we expect from Congress? Because at least from what I've been seeing, you know, we'd expected potentially some action on this regime months ago. We had both of you on our March episode, and then, you know, it was kind of not moving, and then Congress has taken an interest. Now we're getting some traction, but do we expect there to be additional developments? Do we expect maybe will Congress go a different way with this even?
Well, I have to say I always leave everything Congress to Tim. So Tim can pick up on that. But I would just say I think it's quite likely over time that we'll see an expansion of sectors. And I think that is likely to have to be done by an amendment of the executive order. But I think it will be very measured. I believe that there is provision for a review, I think an annual review, if I'm not wrong here, to review the program. And I think that Treasury will use the notifications in the program once it starts to get information that will inform future sectors that might be added. So, I mean, I think I would mention one and then I turn it over to Brian here. But one of the areas that has been in and out and in and out is biotech. And so query whether biotech will ultimately be something that's included. It's clear that there is an interest in doing that on the part of the administration, but maybe just not yet enough surety about how that would work out in that particular context. Anyway, Brian, what are your thoughts on expansion?
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think that ultimately the sectors are going to be expanded. As you said, the executive order explicitly calls for it by virtue of that review that's going to have to come a year after the regs are in place. It seems to me very unlikely that review will result in the executive branch Treasury recommending, oh yeah, well, let's just stick with the three we got. I think it's quite likely that you'll see at least tinkering within those sectors or, you know, subsectors that are already identified in the AMPRAM and the EO. And I think it's possible that at that point, you'd also see additions because, as you noted, the administration is going to learn from the notifications in particular, and some from the public comments that they receive on the AMPRAM and the proposed rule. They're going to learn about what kind of investments are going in or ultimately supporting these Chinese sectors. And some of that might inform how they potentially would expand it. And I think there's also just a more practical reason why it's likely, which is just, you know, technologies evolve and they can sometimes evolve quite quickly. So technologies whose, you know, military defense end uses are not so obvious to us now might be obvious to us in a year or in 18 months. And just because of the way technology develops, I think that makes it quite likely that it will ultimately expand. Where will it expand is as you point out, is it's a little bit difficult to know. You can guess that it could be potentially, again, further expansion within chips, quantum, or AI into more of the subsectors than they've already identified. But it also potentially could expand into sectors that are identified in the congressional legislation. Hypersonics is one, satellite communications is another. But one way or the other, I think it's going to expand. Yeah, Tim, again, as Ann said, welcome your thoughts on, particularly from the congressional angle there. I think not only sort of, you know, sector-wise, et cetera, but we do have this interesting dynamic right now, which is we've got an executive order that's got notification provisions and prohibitions. It's limited to these three sectors, and it's focused on one country. The congressional legislation that's proposed right now is a bit different. It's notification focused. It's got a larger set of countries. It's got a larger set of sectors. So there's a conflict right now between what is planned under the EO based regime and what that legislation foresees. So how do you see that dynamic in Congress playing out?
Right. So obviously this is a dynamic and there's sort of a three-way dynamic here, right? So you've got the EO coming out of the administration. You've got folks on the Hill, both parties, both chambers who are interested in sort of expansive outbound investment regime, both in terms of notification and blocking and sort of sectors. And then you have some other folks on the Hill, most notably Patrick McHenry, who's the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, who are not wild about the idea at all. And so I think that, you know, what you're going to be seeing over the coming months is sort of, you know, kind of a dance between the three. I do think that, you know, there's obviously more energy, if you will, on the side of the folks on the Hill who would like to see some expansion. And obviously, Chairman Gallagher of the House Select Committee on China, you know, has been active in pushing the administration to be as expansive as possible. But I also think there will be, you know, sort of cooler heads, so to speak, who may be willing to allow the Treasury to go ahead, go through the rulemaking process and see what this looks like, you know, and just sort of oversee it very tightly. And in a Congress where it's sort of hard to do things, that may end up, you know, may, you know, be where they end up. But I do think that, you know, this is going to be something going forward into 2024 and beyond, where the Hill and the administration are going to sort of be pushing each other. And actually, hopefully, it could be sort of a constructive process rather than destructive.
Yeah. And to an extent, that's what we've seen already, right? Which was this, there was this originally, it was looking like the legislation. Well, that's clearly going to, the legislation is what's going to come out. And then it was like, no, it's clearly going to be the EO. The EO is going to come out first. And then obviously, we got the proposed legislation that's actually going to be voted on as part of the NDAA this year was first. And then it was followed quite quickly by the EO and the AMPRAM. So, I think that's
real.
That's
the, right. And the, but, you know, the Cornyn-Casey amendment that made it onto the NDAA in the Senate is a notification-only regime.
Right.
So it's kind of one of these things where, you know, and sort of the administration has sort of ratcheted up one level above, you know, what is on the table, so to speak, now on the Hill.
Right. In some ways, the administration, in including prohibitions and notifications, is stronger than what is in, than what is in the Cornyn-Casey legislation. But in some ways, because Cornyn-Casey is broader in terms of the sectors that are covered, so they're each quite different.
Stunning to see the government actually sort of working the way it's supposed to, even if in a very discreet sector.
Right. Good point.
So finally, I guess, you know, you've talked before, Ann and Brian, about sort of the need for clients and others to be thinking about weighing in during this comment period. Are there other steps that companies, entities should be taking now in advance of this? You mentioned that, you know, it's probably not going to hit for, you know, another, you know, 8 to 12 months at a minimum. My understanding is that it's not retrospective, so that's not necessarily an issue, but are there some basic things that we're advising clients that they should be doing or thinking about now?
Yeah, well, I'm sure I sound like a broken record on this, of course, but as we've noted before, I think the most important thing is to take a look and to see whether you want to comment during this 45-day period. But I think beyond that, it's really useful for clients to engage in, I don't know, what might be termed some form of a tabletop exercise that based on what's in the EO and the AMPRAM now, even though what you ultimately see here may be very different from what is in the AMPRAM. It probably will be different from what's in the AMPRAM now. So I think if you do that, that will allow you to see where your vulnerabilities might be. And we know what the basic framework is. So those allowing to see your vulnerabilities now and then adjusting them as there are various iterations of this regime that are in place going forward, I think is useful. And then I would just say on the retroactivity point, Tim, it is true that they want to cover things prospectively, but there's some things in the ANPRAM that suggest that they can ask questions of regard certain transactions post EO issuance. So there is some indication that while they're not applying it retroactively, they could be asking questions, which I think, you know, I think for some companies raises this question of reputational risk. So I think there's a lot to think about there, but I think it really is in many companies' best interest to take a close look at it now.
It does make sense to start looking at it, you know, right now, as you said, and particularly because you've got this time period where you might have some ability to influence what the administration is going to do. I mean, to a large extent, we're recommending to clients that they continue a process that we recommended that they begin a while ago, which is to assess their potential exposure. Like we were, you know, before we had the details of the EO or the AMPRAM, but we had a sense of which sectors they were likely to target, we told clients, you know, look at these sectors and particularly in countries such as China, such as Russia, and figure out where you might have some exposure, existing exposure, or where you might be thinking about investing. And so to a degree, we're telling them to do the same thing. And, you know, I've seen some commentary that suggests, oh, well, that, you know, the EO came out and the AMPRAM, but there's no rule. And so, you know, that we haven't really made any progress. And I don't think that's quite right in the sense that there's a little bit, or you might say quite a bit more meat on the bone now, particularly with the AMPRAM, more detail about some elements of this regime. And so I think there's more for clients to chew on, and not only for them to sort of see in some instances where the administration is asking very much open-ended questions and they're not sure which way they're going to go, to sort of potentially now influence which way they go, but in other ways where it's pretty clear that they have a firm position on something, to understand that that's likely the way where they're headed, and that's, you know, and see what the implications of that are for your planned investments. And then I would just also, circling back to a topic we talked about earlier, which is recognizing how non-US investors can be caught by this regime. So the examples that I gave before about, you know, a US investor in a UK quantum computer company that happens to be majority owned by a Chinese citizen. Are investors outside, are US investors in companies like that thinking about those kinds of implications? I'm not sure that many of them are. So they need to examine the EO and figure out, are these kinds of investments that might ultimately be caught by this regime?
A lot of interesting stuff here. I think we'll have to stand by to see where the regulations actually come out. We're going to have you both on again when we have more certainty what the regulations actually look like. Though I would actually also suggest, I think since the comments are often public, you can kind of get a sense what a lot of people's concerns are. So, I mean, you might even want to discuss talking about this after the comment period is closed, because you can glean a lot from what people are saying. So we might see like a lot of really interesting data after like September 28th. So we may have you back on even, you know, right around then to see what reactions are. But Brian and Anne, thank you again for being on the show. It's a hot Friday in August in DC, so I think we should close it off and head out for the weekend. Thanks again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.